be blue, 'cause I can't see you. Richie, I love you.
This is Richie Wexler of Vintage Annals Archive. We totally changed the name of the podcast to the Visionaries and Outsiders Podcast because, I don't know, I realized that people fall into kind of either or both categories. And I just saw it really owning this idea of visionary, which is kind of how I feel about a lot of our guests, in conjunction with outsiders, made the most sense. So today is, we are starting episode 86. Very happy to have talked to Eric Bressler. In Philadelphia, Mausoleum of Contemporary Art. He's been doing this since 97. He's, you know, Eric's a very happy guy, very interesting person, really has his heart in the right place, and really does a lot of work bringing really interesting and unique films and programs to that space. There was a few years back where he really had to fight to keep that space, and I was just really impressed that just a good dude, and he's a really interesting artist as well, and he's done a lot of different film stuff, and we'll get into that in the episode. But I'm very happy to have Eric Bressler on the show this week. Again, please check out Philly Mocha. It's in Philadelphia. You know, if you live closer in Philly, they really have an amazing program there. A lot of they show films. They just do a lot of really great stuff. So please check it out and enjoy.
Hey, my name is Eric Bressler, and I currently run a all-ages multidisciplinary event space in Philadelphia called Philomoka, the Philadelphia Mausoleum of Contemporary Art.
Oh, I never actually knew what that stood for. It's great. I'm glad I do know.
Yeah, there's a lot of, you know, city mochas throughout the country, you know, mass mocha and such. So ours, I think, is the only one that doesn't stand for Museum of Contemporary Art. We are the Mausoleum of Contemporary Art.
Let me ask you a quick question. So was the mausoleum, like, were you looking for that? Or was that just, like, were you excited about that? Or was it just a space that was available?
So I wasn't the founder of Philomoka. I came in 2012. A guy named Gavin took it over from the then current owner in 2010.
Okay.
So it had been around for 2 years at the point that I took it over. Gavin just was moving up to New York City and you know, was just following a different career path, and he decided that he wanted the building to continue and was looking for someone to take it over, and a mutual friend of ours recommended me, and yeah, I dove right in. It was February of 2012, so I just earlier this month hit my 11-year anniversary.
That's amazing. Was the programming of a certain similar or not really?
Well, the programming was few and far between, but yeah, there were similarities. He hosted kind of underground, you know, DIY music shows.
Okay.
He would do art shows. Mainly he used it as kind of a recording video room, you know?
Nice.
Which I've really strayed away from and just concentrated on kind of event curation. Yeah. Showcasing.
Your space would look weird with a giant green screen.
I know. it has been done, but
but go on. Keep
Well, I grew up in upstate New York, Watertown, New York, which is about 15 miles south of Canada. Kind of isolated. The biggest nearby city was Syracuse, which was an hour south of us. Being isolated and having an interest in kind of like underground pop culture, I of course grew up in video stores, you know, just constantly watching stuff, and also I should say comic book stores. I'm still a big comic book.
Just real quick in that, just to kind of tag add to that, when you think about this, are there certain, I don't know, I think a lot of us have these certain films or comic books that are like the hole in your, burned a hole in your brain moment, or just changed your life. Sometimes people don't see that till they're looking back, but is there anything in that time frame you can think that was like, oh, that was like the first time it really woke me up to like this?
Well,
it could be a few things if you want to, you know, make that a longer, it's a big question.
I always think back to Peter Bagg's Hate, you know, in the early to mid 90s. Hate was, you know, it was out of Seattle. It was kind of a critique of the grunge era.
It was a comic book or a film?
Comic book.
My comic knowledge is not the greatest, but
okay.
So you might want to be specific about what those things are.
It had a real kind of punky alternative art style, and it really stood out on the racks, and that attracted me. And then I kind of felt like I was getting this insider view of, you know, alternative music culture at the time,
nice.
Which I really had no awareness of. And I would say that had a huge impact on me coming to Philadelphia in 97 and living, you know, joining the radio station at Drexel University and then living in a succession of punk houses. I wouldn't have known that world even existed if it wasn't for the comic book Hate.
How would you even now identify yourself as punk, if you would?
I certainly don't.
Part of the question, I want to keep it open. I think that's a very big idea. I think punk is an idea more than referencing actual punk music or punk whatever.
Especially now. I'm kind of immersed in youth culture through Philomoka. You know, every 3 or 4 years, there's just a totally new batch of attendees and bands, you know, teenagers and college age people. And, you know, the term punk itself is no longer a lifestyle.
It's no longer punk.
Yeah, there's no uniform associated with it. It is a mindset, and it is a mindset that is a world away from 80s punk or 70s punk.
Doing things non-mainstream to me is punk, and it's a very loose definition.
Yeah, I mean, non-conformity is certainly punk.
Yeah, that's what I'll, let's leave it at there.
I do feel like I was lucky enough to come to Philly in the late 90s where punk was still embodied by what punk was in my mind.
I got you.
You know, it was people who still kind of dressed the part and still kind of acted what I thought punks would look like.
I gotcha.
And you know, hard drinkers and hanging out outside of house shows. And
yeah.
So I felt like I remember being young and feeling like, wow, I'm really getting the punk rock experience.
When you talk about like, you know, going to like Kill Time and Funorama, and I mean,
yeah.
That was I got to West Philly around 2000, which when I look back, it doesn't seem like it would have been that radical compared to now, but it really fucking was, even in like 2000.
Yeah, I mean, I think Stalag and Kill Time closed around 2001. Is that correct?
I think I got to West Philly like 98, but my first night was at Kill Time. It was the nastiest drag show in town, and somebody was selling like sandwiches with cigarette butts in them. And I got to see Dyke. Do you know Dyke?
Mm-mm.
Dyke was one of Darren's, Darren Finzi.
Oh, yeah.
It was Darren and Paul, and they just sung about being lesbians, Dykes, which was very weird.
Darren had that bodybuilder themed band, right?
You ultimately have booked some conceptual acts,
yes,
right? Like, certainly. Have you noticed in those conceptual acts that some of them also book with you as that conceptual character?
Yes, and I love those people that I love the people that you can't tell if they're in character or not, or if they are the character just all the time. I have such a respect and a tolerance for outsider culture, but I've always felt like the outsider to them. Like, I can't necessarily connect with them, but I can enjoy what they perform, you know.
I'm a huge fan of outsider art and music, or any particular, since we're in Philly, you know, any Philadelphia folks or otherwise that were like, you got excited to, that you've gotten to host that were fully in that world?
Well, yeah, there've been so many over the years. One that I just mentioned was Suzanne Muldowney, who has been dressing up as Underdog and doing performance art.
I thought that was made up.
No, since the late 70s.
Holy shit.
She used to go to the Creation Cons, which were like the area's sci-fi conventions in the late 70s. And she would do interpretive dances of Underdog episodes, you know, the old cartoon.
She was dressed as Underdog as well.
Yep.
Holy shit.
Good dress, and she makes her own outfits. And over the years, she branched out. She started doing like a conceptual Dracula performance and such. But she lives right over the bridge from Philly in South Jersey. And honestly, like I think I first brought her in the first year that I was at Philomoka because I was just such a fan. And yeah, she's performed annually since then. She performed at my wedding.
Holy shit, man.
She's just fully embodies her interest and really not concerned about talking about anything else.
Yeah.
Interesting lady. yeah, I was trying to think back to things where I've seen so many things in that room where I was just like, geez, like, is this appropriate? Is this? But one that comes to mind is there was an opening act once for a comic book artist. So the headliner of this event was a comic book artist who sang sea shanties on, like, you know, a little ukulele. So that's the headliner, right?
Okay.
One of the openers was a local performance artist who ended her set by putting this like metal hook up her bottom on stage, and attached to it was a jump rope, and she had two people from the audience come up, one to hold the jump rope and the other to do the jumping. And it just caught everyone in the crowd off guard, because it didn't seem the least bit thematically similar to the headliner that night. Yeah, so that was wild. That always comes to mind.
That is a good one.
But yeah, you know, like yeah,
let me just chime in. I think there's a certain I've noticed over the years there's certain acts either I've seen or just known of who you feel like their intention is to make the audience leave.
I think you have to respect those guys whose goal is to just alienate their crowd. there's a local band that I will name. They're called Shy Boys, and they are a band that present what they do, and they have no concern for how the audience will accept it. And I have seen them clear out some rooms. One time I booked them to open for Lydia Lunch, and during their set, I went up to her and I was like, "What do you think?" And like, she was just speechless.
you stumped Lydia Lunch. Holy fuck! I don't know. Yeah, she must have seen the craziest fucking shit in your space. Kind of brought her. She's been in New York for 15 years, and she comes to Philadelphia and like, "Oh, I'm dying. I'm out. This is too much."
Yeah, Lydia's great. We've had her in a bunch, and she was a big fan of our neighbor, Little Sean, who was a he started coming to our room when he was 10. And, you know, he's helped out in our room for like 10 years. So we've seen him grow up. I remember the second time she came to the room, she pulled up in her car. And right when she opened the door, she said, "Where's Little Sean?" And I love that. He would always work her merchandise table for her.
Oh, nice. Is Little Sean still Little Sean, or has he gone to Big Sean? Or just
he's
Sean?
About to become 21, but he still lives on the block. And yeah, we still call him that. But yeah, so that was just an example of a band who's kind of doing their own thing with no concern for anyone else. And I think that's definitely to be you know, respected.
Let's shift to, I know you managed TLA for a long time. So that's, you know, and I know you said you did a documentary about Japanese animation, which seems amazing. So are you willing to talk a little bit about that frame of your life? Because I know you guys also, I mean, what I love about your space, and I don't get there enough, unfortunately, I don't get out a lot, honestly, but whenever I've been there, it's one of my favorite spaces in terms of the programming. And it seems like, you know, you host a lot of film, and there must be a connection in that time frame. So I'm just curious about your own, you know, your own documentary and, I don't know, other the world of film you were in terms of TLA, because that was, you know, I don't think people understand, but TLA, in a similar way that Tower Records did, brought a lot of weird shit that you wouldn't have been able to see otherwise.
Totally. So yeah, my first weekend in Philadelphia, when I came to go to college at Drexel, they handed out these like coupon books. I think they're kind of common. You get, you know, it's local businesses advertising things. And there was one for the TLA video store. So that first weekend I went down to the Locust Street location. And I was just amazed. It was the biggest collection of things that I'd never had access to that I'd ever seen. And, you know, I was there once a week my entire freshman year. And it was like a dream to someday work at a TLA video, where it really seemed like this kind of exclusive club. It seemed like the employees were allowed to kind of treat the customers however they wanted. They could comment on what you were renting. They could make fun of what you were renting. And just as far as like an archive goes, it was amazing.
Oh man. Is there anything you can think about that you got to see in those days that just kind of blew your mind?
The first thing I ever rented from a TLA was the Shaw Brothers Hammer Films collaboration, the Seven Golden Vampires. Yeah, I was really, and still am really into like martial arts and Hong Kong cinema. That was my thing in high school. And there was this Shaw Hammer collaboration that I always wanted to see. And so that was like the first thing I looked for there. And of course they had it. No video store in upstate New York carried that one. But I mean, that was how I saw like, you know, Jodorowsky films, which I'd never had access to. You know, Argento films outside of Suspiria, which was the only thing I'd seen. Yeah, like at that point in time, the this was pre-Landmark for the Ritz theaters. So like the, you know, the three Ritz theaters just always had things to see. It was just constant. So I was going to them a lot.
I know I saw you a bunch over the years at a light, I guess Lightbox, which used to be iHouse. Did that further? I mean, they have such a good program there. Did that further your education?
Yeah, of course. iHouse, it's the best film programming, consistent film programming that the city, I think, will ever see. The first time I ever went to iHouse was my freshman year. It was October of 97. I went to see a documentary called Sick. It was about the super masochist Bob Flanagan. I don't know if you're familiar with the story. A fantastic documentary, real rough watch. I think there were four other people, and two of which didn't make it through the film. But yeah, it was the only place that it showed in all of Philadelphia. And that was my first exposure to like a movie theater that wasn't necessarily like a traditional, you know, you walk in the lobby past a snack stand and all that, you know. Like it felt really special and kind of secretive. And so, yeah, I was a member of the iHouse for years and years, all the way up till when they closed. And during slow times, I would be there multiple times a week.
Were you a big Exhumed? I guess, I mean, Exhumed was connected with them briefly, but were you in that world as well?
Yeah, still a big Exhumed guy. We still host at Philomoka Exhumed once a month. And I go to Harry's house every week to watch movies. But yeah, my first Exhumed show was at the Harwin in New Jersey.
That movie theater they used to use?
Yep. I think it was their first theater. That was in 98. It was it was From Beyond and probably Reanimator.
Beyond I'm a big horror person. That's kind of like a lost classic. I rewatched it a few years ago. I was like, holy shit.
Oh, it's great. You know, it's like it is if you're a Reanimator fan, it's like more of that. It's but more kind of more self-contained in this home. Wild movie.
I want to shift to the documentary that you did about Japanese animation, which I was not expecting that.
Since high school, I'd been really into Japanese music. I think that just came out of like, you know, when you're in high school, you start to learn that there's record labels and they specialize in different things, you know. So I listened to a lot of Matador record stuff and had, you know, Cornelius and Pizzicato 5. And I was like, this stuff is so different than you know, not only their other artists, but all of their music I've heard of. So that kind of just led me to explore Japanese music. When I was in college at Drexel, I did an all Japanese music radio show. And of course, the archives there had tons of stuff that I'd never had access to.
What are some bands that fall in that, just for our listeners? I never think about the listeners, but I've been reminded of them.
There was a huge garage rock scene at that time in Japan. So it's like Guitar Wolf, Teen Generate, Jackie and the Cedrics. You know, really just vibrant scene of lo-fi garage rock, some of which was more listenable than others. Like take Guitar Wolf, where like they'll have a whole album with the heaviest distortion you've ever heard, and it's like and then there's bands that kind of harnessed more of a like a 60s pop sound. Yeah, so there was and there were like Devo type bands like Polysix from Japan and the Spoogies from Japan. There's a lot going on at that time. So that kind of interest in Japanese music led me to my first Japanese animation convention. A world that I had no involvement or familiarity with, but I was like, oh, maybe, you know, there'll be dealers who sell CDs or whatever. So a buddy of mine went to a convention in Baltimore, I believe. It was just this whole world that I was unfamiliar with. It had its own lingo and its own dress code, and it was huge. And you know, I just started looking into it. And aside from like local, you know, news reports about these conventions happening, there was no coherent story telling, you know, the tale of how Speed Racer and Marine Boy in the 60s, you know, being imported for the youth of the time, led to this giant fan movement in the, you know, late 90s, early 2000s. And, you know, currently it's bigger than ever. It hasn't slowed down. So I needed a project for my senior project at school, and I decided to shoot a short documentary, just go to like half a dozen conventions, shoot interviews with the organizers and with the celebrities and attendees, and then just kind of put together the story of how we got to this point. Yeah, I think it was like a 15-minute short. It was, I'd say it was pretty professional for like a film school senior.
So you were studying film at Drexel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this was right when digital cameras started being introduced. So when I was a freshman at Drexel, we were shooting on VHS cameras. By the time we graduated, they had like the first wave of those digital cameras, you know.
I went to the Art Institute, and when I started there, around the same time as you, we were doing animation onto a VHS tape from like a shitty camera with this little clicker. And it was like, anyway, but go on.
Yeah, the editing days, I remember, were two VCRs and, you know, with a thing in between them. So yeah, but by that time, I'd also set up a website, which enabled me to kind of get interviews with people because it showed like a bit of professionalism was happening. So by the time I graduated, this 15-minute short had this kind of following in that animation fandom. And so I just decided, hey, why don't I expand this to be feature length? I think there's enough material here. So very small crew of friends and I continued to travel for the next, on and off for the next year and a half, going to other conventions and going to businesses related to the industry. And yeah, and then that culminated in 2004 when the 70-minute feature premiered at the Philadelphia Film Festival, the Opal.
That's amazing. Who were some of the like holy grail people you got to meet or talk to in that process?
I spoke to the voice cast of Speed Racer, which I thought was cool. Peter Fernandez and Corrine Orr, who both did multiple voices on the show, including the main characters. I talked to a lot of the people who like everybody knows within that fandom and that don't exist outside of that fandom, which is still an interesting thing to me. But yeah, I talked to a lot of like translators whose like comic books I had read, you know, their translations or novels. I spoke to a lot of people that had been in the fandom since it began, people that had organized groups in the 70s that were still around. And yeah, it was just really interesting to hear their takes on like these young people coming into this new hobby and how this hobby had changed over the years to where it was kind of unrecognizable for the older people who grew up, you know, like tape trading, sending each other like lists in the mail of what they have, you know, to this like, you know, the shelves at Suncoast being stocked with accessible anime and cable channels showing anime all the time.
Did you get into like books and stuff or manga?
It was mostly animation based, but the manga stuff goes hand in hand. And I tried not to concentrate too much on like the costuming aspect of it, which was a huge deal when I made this movie. And you know, costuming goes back to like the 70s. It goes back to Underdog Lady at the 70s.
I need to learn more about her. I might have to interview her after you at some point. She's in my world.
Oh, she's great. She doesn't have a computer, but you know, you could do it in person. But yes, yeah, so yeah, it was this kind of little senior project that became this bigger thing, and it screened, I don't know, over 50 times in the US at film festivals and conventions. It was subtitled in multiple languages and distributed throughout the world. I went to the first New York Comic Con for the release of the DVD. That was fun. So yeah, it was like, you know, it's something that I don't really think about a lot. But the funny thing, though, is that it continues to exist because there was this one subject in the film who kind of represented the obsessive aspect of that fandom. Not the most self-aware guy. He's the guy, you know, and I don't mean to demean him at all, but he was kind of in there to serve as a kind of like comic relief for the audience.
Oh, I feel bad now.
Yeah, see, like it's hard, you know.
I know where you're. I know where you're at. I get you.
It's the same thing as when you deal with outsider performers. It's like some people laugh at them. Some people are legitimately fascinated by them. it's a tough thing to kind of deal with, to to rationalize why you like this stuff. Well, you know, it's the same thing when I program a lot of these people. It's like, how do you rationalize putting someone up on stage who you know will not get like the typical reaction from a crowd?
Does it really matter how someone reacts to something if your intention is meant to honor that person? And it's a big question. I don't have the answer.
Yeah, it's something I've grappled with many times. I remember when Crispin Glover was at iHouse, and there was a person during the Q&A who had a back and forth with him about that topic. And I think his conclusion was like, this man wanted his story to be told and he wanted to star in his story. Why would I not help him do so?
Right.
You know, yeah, it's a tough thing to rationalize. It's something that I've dealt with many, many times over the years. I remember getting flack when I booked this multiple alien abductee named Riley Martin, one of two abductees that I've booked over the years. But Riley Martin was a big name. He had his own weekly radio show on Howard Stern's Sirius channel, a longtime Stern guest. And, you know, there were people that said it was inappropriate to book him because he's mentally ill. And it's like, well, there is no evidence of that. The way I always saw Riley Martin was that he was a huckster. He would sell tons of merchandise related to these abductions that he went through. You know, like the aliens put all of these, he called them symbols in his head. And for $50, he would draw you one of the symbols, you know, like I think it was, this was just like a means to kind of generate money in a funny way.
I guess it depends if like someone's in on the joke, it's probably a different conversation by booking them than if they're not.
Yeah. So here another abductee that I interviewed was a gentleman, David Huggins, who there's a fantastic documentary about this guy. It's called Love in Saucers. David has been abducted since the 70s. He lost his virginity to an alien named Crescent. All of his life, he's made these beautiful acrylic paintings of his experiences on, you know, other worlds. And so there's this great documentary about him, very respectful. And I did an art show of his. We showed the documentary. He came in and did a really good Q&A, and we put his art up on all the walls. So when you do something like that, you try to like kind of predict the audience. You're like, all right, there's people that are going to come laugh at this guy who says he lost his virginity to an alien. But yeah, so that you just try to anticipate the people that are going to come out. And there's all these, you know, different people. There's people who want to laugh. There's people who are interested. There are people who just like are curious about this, you know, out of the ordinary situation. And at the end of the night, you hope that everybody was respectful and everyone had a good time. So going back to the documentary, when this specific subject first reached out to me saying he's a big fan, I could tell that he was one of those obsessive type fans, and that corner of this Japanese animation fandom had to be represented in the movie because it's a big deal. Like, those people are at all the conventions, I noticed.
Right.
You know, and it's the same thing that I saw at comic conventions growing up. There's people that kind of take it a bit too far, that are territorial, that don't
want
people. This guy kind of embodied that. So so there's these segments following him throughout. He had a radio show. I filmed him there. He did a costume contest thing. I filmed that. And during the screenings of this Japanese animation documentary, he always got laughs, or you know, people just kind of shocked at his behavior. The thing that has prevented this documentary from being forgotten, you know, now 20 years later, is the fact that people have become fans of this guy
through the documentary.
Yeah. And in addition to the documentary itself, apparently he's caused a lot of scenes, public scenes, over the years.
Okay.
Has become a bit of a legend, and the only video proof of this guy existing is this documentary. So if you go on YouTube and search for the documentary, you know, multiple people have uploaded it, but then you'll find all of these young people doing videos about this guy. You'll see footage of this guy from my documentary from 20 years ago remixed in with like techno songs, you know. It's kind of an amazing thing.
If people want to see the documentary, where can they find it and what is it called?
Just find it on YouTube. I let the distribution rights lapse, and it's called Otaku Unite. That's O-T-A-K-U Unite, and that's a Japanese word for kind of an obsessive fan.
Had you ever thought about doing a second part to this?
I don't have a lot of interest in film production at this moment.
I got you.
But it's a fantastic idea, because that what was kind of a subculture at that point, still in the late 90s, it's now this giant mainstream thing. You know, a lot of people have made a lot of money on this. I could go to my local theater right now and see an anime movie at night. You know, it's kind of amazing. So yeah, there is the material to make an interesting, like, how did we get from here in 2000 to here, you know, 20, 25 years later. So yeah, it's something I might do. I also have a ton of, I shot thousands of hours of footage for this 70-minute thing. I have so many like strange and crazy outtakes that I would like to show someday. I might do that as like a film.
More of a presentation than a film.
Yeah. I've really grown to prefer presentations over film.
Segue to this, and you know, you would give me, I asked you a list of like some of your favorite events you've hosted and over the years, and I wanted to get in some of those. One of those was the Erasure Forever event. Tell me about that one if you can, and maybe if you have any fandom of Twin Peaks or Eraserhead or that whole world.
Yeah. So in high school, you know, when I started branching out and watching more adult cinema, of course I went right to like Blue Velvet.
Yeah.
And, you know, in Eraserhead, I remember I was a big so I was in high school, you know, in the mid to late 90s.
Okay.
And we just gotten the internet in the form of this service called Prodigy, which was kind of like an AOL type service provider. And through that, I was finally able to enter like the VHS tape trading world. And, so one of the first tapes that I was able to get was a copy of Eraserhead, which none of our local video stores had. And it was a dub of a Japanese Laserdisc. So it was letterboxed. And I watched that over and over and over. I still have that exact copy. So, and I actually wrote my essay to get into college on Eraserhead.
Holy shit. What was that? What was the focus on that?
You know, I don't even recall. I think it was just like me showing that I could interpret a film. I'm sure my interpretation was way off at that time. Although I guess that's a film that kind of lends itself to a personal interpretation.
I mean, I feel like you could, 100 people would have different interpretations of that movie.
So yeah, through watching those, I discovered Twin Peaks, and my first job in high school was at a record store at the mall. And I ordered the, you know, 6-tape VHS Twin Peaks set and just devoured that and watched it over and over and over. When I lived at the Astrocade, which was at 10th and Ridge.
This happens often because I have long talks. And I'm thinking like, do I invest in a toilet chair? I don't know if it feels right to do adult diapers while I'm talking to people.
No, nothing wrong with an intro.
But go on. Sorry.
Should I recap?
From the beginning. Where did I cut you off?
I was talking about, I was going to say that I lived at the Astrocade and that.
Start there. There. And I'll cut it from the other piece.
So in 2001, I moved to a warehouse space at 10th and Ridge, the Astrocade. And, I was aware that I was within blocks of where David Lynch lived when he was a student at PAFA, and that his experience in this neighborhood was what directly influenced Eraserhead. Okay, so, and I also lived there in 2003 at the Astrocade when it was seized by L&I and shut down because it wasn't zoned for residential living.
Where was the Astrocade, just out of curiosity?
10th and Ridge, so...
okay, so not far from where you're at now.
Yeah, exactly. So it's literally like a block from the Trestle Inn, which it was a different type of Trestle Inn back then.
I prefer the older Trestle Inn than the new one, but
it's a different world. The Astrocade is now, you know, a 6-floor condo building. And the developer put a little plaque out front and that mentions the Astrocade as like an experimental venue.
Let me just shift for a second. I'm wondering, in terms of your space, I know you had some troubles with your space. Yeah. How has like gentrification affected you, you're having that space, if at all?
So when I took over Philomoka in 2012, development was happening in the neighborhood, but it was all south of Spring Garden. We're barely north of Spring Garden, but regardless of that, It felt like a preserved, secretive neighborhood with long-term residents. I don't think that like college students were necessarily living there yet. I mean, this is before like the Divine Lorraine was revamped. You know, it was before that they put up that giant supermarket and all that stuff. There was still a basketball court next to Philomoka at that time. So in 2012, developers hadn't started buying up in our direct vicinity just yet. Okay. But it was just a matter of years. I think the basketball court was gone by 2014. It became, you know, six apartments. We started seeing a lot more college students living in the neighborhood. So yeah, we've definitely seen a change just, you know, just right outside of our front door. They're about to put like an 80 unit building across the street from us with no parking. It's going to kill the neighborhood. But yeah, we were there slightly before all that. Knowing that at this point, the neighborhood had been given this nickname, the Eraser Hood, because of Lynch's former presence in the neighborhood. Nobody could ever really pinpoint who created that nickname, but I started kind of exploiting it. And as a Lynch fan, I started playing up the fact that he lived in this neighborhood, and I started doing this annual Eraser Hood Forever event.
And was that to kind of keep your space, protect yourself more or less?
It was to preserve the name of the neighborhood, or the name of the neighborhood, I should say, because the neighborhood has had, when you look into it, it's had so many different names over the years. You know, it's like Callow Hill, which is kind of the other side of Spring Garden, but it's still applied to us. There was West Poplar, the Loft District. Developers had given it a lot of different names over the years. And so we kind of like just planted our flag and said, hey, we are the Eraser Hood. And it really caught on to the point where there's like businesses now that use that name in their business name. So yeah, I started doing this annual event. David Lynch themed, kind of open as far as what disciplines would be featured. You know, it's been everything from like a year of local bands to bringing in, you know, actors from Twin Peaks. One year we had the band Shushu perform a soundtrack to Twin Peaks. Yeah, they only did that a few times around the world. So that was really special.
You said Sherilyn Fenn was there at one point.
Sherilyn Fenn was there. James Marshall came in. My favorite was when I found the woman who played the lady in the radiator in Eraserhead, you know, the one with the big cheeks, and she does performance of the song In Heaven. Doesn't sing it in the film, but lip syncs it in the film. And
it's a hard film, I gotta say, but a good one.
Yeah, yeah. It's not the most accessible film. I think it says a lot about you if you're a fan of it who watches it repeatedly. But yeah, my favorite Eraserhood event was when I found her in California. She was a music teacher now. I flew her in and she sang In Heaven live with the Divine Hand Ensemble backing her up. You know, which is, if you're familiar, it's a local.
A little bit. Yeah. Drum hand. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Divine Hand. Local, like kind of 10-piece chamber orchestra led by theremin player Mano Divina.
Yeah. So, I've seen them in different capacities over the years. Good stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, great, great band. So they did that. They were the accompaniment for her to sing In Heaven live. And it was nice. It's one of my favorite things that I ever created. Like when I go back and look at that video, I'm like, wow, Eric, you did a good job with this one. And I rarely look.
I mean, I think what you're doing is art. Do you see curating as art in your own? I mean, what you're saying there, do you feel like that's part of your curating? Do you feel like it's an art to do this stuff or not so much?
There is an art to it. It is not always art. I always compare it to like forming a bill for a concert, you know, getting together three or four bands. Is there an art to that? There can be, but not always. I think that the events that are in-house Philomoka events that qualify as art are really obvious. Stuff like the really elaborate public access retrospectives that I've done for like Beyond Vaudeville.
Well, let's get into that one. It's segue to that because that was your second one.
Beyond Vaudeville specifically was a New York City based public access show from the 80s, ran through the early 90s. It was also a stage show. It had such visibility that MTV picked it up in the late 90s and retitled it Oddville.
Okay, I've never heard of this. I'm excited to check.
Rich Brown, the creator and host, is just endlessly impressive. He is a modern Barnum. He has the ability to find outsider talent like you've never seen, Huge influence on what I present at Philomoka. You know, just to give you an idea of the type of guests, you know, he'd have like Tiny Tim. Suzanne Muldowney, Underdog Lady, was a frequent guest. And then he would have just local talents like plate spinners or like elderly singers, fan club presidents.
Did he ever host, I can't think of her last name, Beverly? She was in Basket Case. I feel like these worlds might have converged. Have you ever seen her Papa Gasta show?
I'm not sure if I have, actually.
Oh my, Beverly Bonner. Oh my God. Go back to it, but check it out. It's beyond, it seems like it was in this world, but go back. Cool. I'm sorry.
We have had Hennenlotter in a few times, the director of Basket Case. But yeah, so Rich had this public access show that just featured all outsider people. And it was in this strange, like, circus-like pop culture environment. And the hosts were, not to break any walls, but the hosts were playing characters themselves. It all just felt very alien and yet very cohesive. Yeah, amazing show. And then, you know, MTV picked it up, and it was really a similar show on MTV, but they had to feature a musical guest every time. It was kind of shoehorned in. But yeah, the format still worked. And then, of course, Rich went on to be like the talent scout for Jimmy Kimmel, and he produced Fear Factor, and had a real natural evolution to his career.
The next one you mentioned, which I'm very excited about, I'm a big Found Footage Festival fan. We just talked to Nick, and we're talking to Joe in a little bit. I love those guys.
Yeah, they were in a couple months ago at Philomoka.
Yeah, and they I know they featured Stairway to Stardom, which is why I wanted to talk about that, because, you know, I love that kind of shit beyond anything else. Tell me about the Stairway to Stardom retrospective.
So Stairway to Stardom differed from Beyond Vaudeville in that local New York talent would write in and pay to be on the show to showcase their talents. Yes.
So, it was like payola?
Yes. So I think it was like $10 or $20. Actually, one of the archivists of the show once showed me a check. But so basically, you know, like, hey, my child's really talented. She's a tap dancer. Here's $20. Please put her on your show. And the hosts, Frank and Tilly Massey, you know, they would just kind of treat every amateur performer like they were really talented and like they had a real future ahead of them. And thanks to the internet and people like Found Footage Festival, this show has really, you know, had legs and become this amazing thing. People know clips from Stairway to Stardom, even if they have no idea where it originally came from, like the song Hairdresser. It's a classic, and it lives on its own without knowing any of the background. So I did the retrospective, which in my mind was very impressive. I reunited the band that sang the theme song for the show, All the President's Men, and they were all super psyched to do it. So they all came down from New York. They performed the theme song. They performed Neil Diamond's America, which they had performed on the show in the 80s. I brought in the co-host, Tilly Massey. Frank Massey was no longer with us. I edited together, you know, kind of like thematic best ofs, like singers, dancers, children. And yeah, it was a fantastic night, under-attended event, but, you know, very niche subject matter. Yeah, one of my, I'd say, top 10 favorites that I've done.
All right, so let's go into events with this, if you want to. Are you cool with the Satanic Temple?
Yeah, I love those guys.
Is it the one in, do you know which group it was?
It's the one out of, their headquarters is in Salem. And they are a national organization that does really great work. They recently just opened the first satanic abortion clinic. An amazing group, real like free speech fighters.
Yeah, I'm a big fan. I didn't know if it was a localized group. I do photography for the local group here. I didn't know if it was tied to them or if it was tied to just another group. But
they have self-run chapters throughout the country, probably throughout the world at this point. But we always work directly with the founder, Lucian Greaves. So we had him in multiple times. Some of the most controversial Philomoka stuff was when we hosted them for a Black Mass, and word got out to local religious groups, and I was then kind of like pummeled by hate mail, and I actually have some. Do you want to?
Yeah, I would love that. I'm like, my one of my favorite things is to like, I love hate mail. I'm hoping to get more of it.
So I have this folder called Satan Complaints, but they're not.
Let's read a few of these. If you can find them, let's read a few of these.
This is going back to 2018. And this is when I received a lot of hate mail emails and physical letters concerning the fact that we were hosting a Black Mass with the Satanic Temple. Very stressful at the time, but I can look back and laugh. So here's just a few excerpts. Are you sick to have Satanic Masses? What's wrong with you anyway? Let me know.
Let me know.
The content of many of your shows listed on your website is turning our town into a cesspool. This one just said it is.
I agree with that 100%.
This is a good one. Should you fail to cancel this event, such or some comparable tragedy is the predictable outcome, and the nightmares to follow will rob you of a peaceful night's sleep.
And were these personally addressed to you or more to the space?
They're all to Eric.
There you go.
Yeah, they will rob you of a peaceful night's sleep for the rest of your guilt-ridden life. That's just a few. My favorite thing was when the night before the Black Mass, we had a... just a regular local indie rock show. One of the religious people dressed up like a rock and roller and infiltrated the room. I didn't know about this, of course, until after the fact, when the guy wrote a really long blog post about his journey, complete with photos. He paid to get in. He hid little medallions around the room. Like, he hid them behind frames and in
corners. What kind of medallions? Like religious medallions?
I mean, they were like half an inch wide. They had a saint on them. I mean, we found them all over time.
I'm just wondering who the saints that were going to save this event would have been.
Right. He had a bottle of holy water, which he spread around the room to contain the evil. And, yeah, his blog post is just fantastic. And, he was in and out in like 15 minutes. That's what he said in his post. So yeah, really stressful at the time. Actually only ended up with two, protesters out front who were there for like 24 hours. Everybody was real respectful to them. But yeah, you know, at the end of the day, it's just a theatrical piece. It's not like, you know, Black Mass isn't going to have any effect. With the amount of interaction we have with people, it's like I've had to deal with a lot of criticism or controversy over the years.
What are some other events that kind of cause, and if you have any other letter proof to read? Anything else that you got a lot of slack from?
The most annoying things to me are like when someone complains about something that they have no right to. I won't even get into those. One of my favorite things that I've created with Philomoka is the Philadelphia Psychotronic Film Society. Oh, awesome. So yeah, we meet twice a month. It's very democratic. Every member takes a turn picking the movie for that meeting. When it started out in 2016, you know, it was just kind of something that I thought like friends would come to, you know, and then it just grew into this much bigger thing. There's over 250 members now. So when we started out in 2016, I didn't really have any rules in place. And there was this period of time where it felt like the people picking the films were kind of trying to outdo each other in how offensive the film could be. And or not necessarily, maybe they just really enjoyed these films and they thought, hey, you know, a sophisticated audience will be able to, you know, watch this on a level of art, you know. So with kind of this democratic system of film programming, it's led to a lot of films where the room has just completely cleared out. The first one was a great guy picked this film called Gestapo's Last Orgy, which was a Nazi exploitation film. So over the top that I actually find it difficult to be offensive because it's so cartoony, but that led to like a huge like blow up in the room that carried on online for days, and that showed me that I do have to institute some sort of warning system for those who are coming in blind. And you know what, one of our older members who recently showed a great sexploitation film, in his intro he said that he doesn't believe in prior warning or trigger warnings and all that, and I totally respect that. But I also think that that's the opinion of someone from an older generation. I think younger generations, they're not more sensitive, but it's just kind of polite to warn people what they're getting into. And honestly, from a programmer perspective, somebody's taking the time to leave their home at night and come out to your event. It's like, make sure that they're comfortable. Make sure they have a good time.
I'm gonna argue a little bit, but I hear you. It's a tricky road because once you go down that road and you start thinking about what could offend someone, it could be fucking everything.
Sure. Well, what do you think about this? I showed Irreversible last week, the Gaspar Noé film. Amazing film. It contains a very notorious 9-minute rape.
I would have put a warning on that one.
So I warned that it contained warning extreme violence and sexual violence. Is that enough in your head?
I would have put rape on there.
See, yeah, that's what somebody told me to do. I hate giving away plot points. I hate it. That's why with the psychotronic stuff, it's like warning may contain extreme content, because I don't want to reveal any aspects of the film that will affect the viewing. But yeah, so like I'm not one to characterize it, you know, any generation, but I do think that current youth expects to be warned more than previous generation. Yeah, I have only over the years drawn the line at any performers who had any sort of Nazi affiliation. That is where I draw the line.
Let's segue and get in House, which I love. I fucking that movie. I've probably seen it 6-7 times, but it definitely was one of those on my list that I finally. That movie's a fucking amazing. I remember reading about it, and it was like. We were trying to make Jaws. All they meant was they were trying to make a big Hollywood movie, which I guess they did. Maybe. What are your feelings? You're the one that, you know more about this than I do.
I mean, House is a classic by a highly regarded Japanese filmmaker whose output beyond that film is virtually unknown in the U.S. It was legitimately written by his, I believe, 8-year-old daughter at the time.
Based on what?
It's just an imaginary story she wrote about girls going to a house that's haunted. Isn't that amazing? Chigumi. And she was in attendance for our screenings with the filmmaker, which, I still think he's the coolest guest we've ever had. We were really lucky in that he had been flown to the U.S. to do screenings at Harvard.
Okay.
His translator was someone that I just happened to be friendly with, good friends with. And they had some downtime and they wanted to see Philadelphia. And he was like, hey, can you quickly set up some screenings for them? And I was like, yeah, of course. So we did 2 sold out screenings of Haosu with the filmmaker and his daughter who wrote the film. You know, that's like museum quality events right there.
I mean, I got to say, in terms of what are you going to do, I look at what you're doing in the same way of like some. The programming is to me is art museum level in terms of some of the shit you're doing. So it's always been very impressive.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's kind of amazing that like in like travel books, like for other countries coming to the U.S., Filmoka is in there and it's listed, alongside the art museum. And it's like these two institutions couldn't be like more different, like funding wise and size wise and audience wise. But it's kind of amazing that we've been able to kind of stand alongside these established institutions. It's a lot of work. The most work was when we were shut down by the city in late 2019 due to zoning issues, and it took a year and a half to reopen. We were able to reopen right, as the pandemic was waning.
Can I ask if there were politics involved with that?
No, I can say that there were a lot of theories floating around as to why we were shut down. I never got a specific answer. I was told that we would not have been shut down unless somebody specifically reported us. So something was behind our shutdown. I don't know if it was a developer, which was heavily rumored. We had terrible neighbors across the street at that time who were just always out causing trouble. They probably lived in those apartments for a year, but they were just always causing trouble in the neighborhood. I don't know why, but it was a really stressful experience reopening. And that was really the first time this period from 2019 to 2021 when I realized how much the room meant to people. We had to go to a zoning meeting and, like 50, 60 people came out to show their support. And I was like, you guys are crazy. This is awesome. And then, of course, to survive because the pandemic happened, it was 2 punches back to back. So I had to do fundraising, which I had never done. I've never fundraised for anything. But just to stay alive, I had to fundraise. And, at the end of the day, people donated. It was like over $50,000. It was incredible.
I mean, except for like, you guys and like the iHouse and Exhumed, there's not a lot of places taking big risk at programming, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think that we show that the audience is here in the city. They just need a place to go.
I want to just ask you a quick question about some of the coolest people you've met, maybe not directly through just through all the work you've done over the years that I've been excited for you to have met and talked to.
Whenever I meet someone through Philomoka, somebody that I personally admire or am a fan of, I always think of that saying, you know, don't meet your heroes. Isn't that how the saying goes?
Something like that. For good reason.
Yeah, for good reason, because sometimes like meeting them will completely change how you think about them and kind of ruin what you love. But I've met amazing people. We did, David Lynch came and visited one time. Quiet guy, just hung out in the room for a little while. I showed him like archival materials of the room from like the late 1800s.
You just walked in randomly?
No, it was scheduled. It was when he, he had a retrospective at PAFA. His, you know, handler just fit him in for a quick visit. It was a real treat. So it was cool meeting him. Are you familiar with that movie The Room, modern cult classic?
Can I share a quick story associated to The Room?
Yeah.
So I was doing that as a benefit, so I didn't really like worry about rights, which, you know, obviously is problematic.
Yeah.
And I got a call from, I'm pretty sure, Tommy Wiseau, pretending to be his own manager, left me this very angry at demanding money, which we paid him some. It was it was one of those things where it was like, I generally will try to pay for that stuff, but it was a benefit and I just couldn't afford I didn't understand the rules at that point yet, that even if it's a benefit, you can't just do it without permission.
Yep, that's how it works.
But I wish I still had that message, because it's the best thing I've ever heard.
I received a cease and desist from Tommy Wiseau, a legitimate one, hand delivered from a lawyer's office. And that was followed by emails from him under that pseudonym of his agent or whatever. That was when we were showing the world premiere of a documentary about him that he didn't authorize. And in the documentary, these Canadian filmmakers actually found his family and his lineage and exposed where he was from, what his actual story was.
So you had the rights to show this, just not... But it was, he was not happy about it.
He prevented it. And then he fought them in court for years. And as far as I know, the film still hasn't screened anywhere. So I think he successfully buried it. It was called Room Full of Spoons. But yeah, so related to The Room, we've had the guy who plays Mark, the co-lead in it, Greg Sestero. I've had him in every year since 2013. And he is just one of my favorite guests. Coolest guy. Super appreciative of this path that his life has taken. I booked him kind of early on. This was right when his book was being published about his experience making The Room, which was of course later made into, you know, a big Hollywood film. And yeah, he's one of my favorite guests. He always brings something special to The Room. Like last time he did an unannounced world premiere in our room of his new horror film. Yeah, I just think it's so cool that he treats The Room like that, like it's like the special place.
Who is there's a guy you've hosted, I don't know his name, but he's out there from like, it's not very well known, but you've done like three or four of his films. You know what I'm talking about?
Neil Breen?
Yes. I don't know anything about him, but I'm curious to just ask about your connection with him.
As far as like modern cult cinema goes, Neil Breen is really the only successor to Tommy Wiseau. And Neil Breen's made, what, 7 films now. Las Vegas-based former architect. He writes, directs, and stars in all of his films. A real enigma. I actually was able to have him in person to Philomoka, which is kind of a rarity. He doesn't do a lot of appearances. Interesting guy. Really believes in what he's making. Tough to tell if he's this real outsider filmmaker or if he plays into what his audiences expect.
Okay.
You know, that happens. Like his first two films, which were very low budget and very pure, once those catch on and he sees audiences packing, you know, theaters to kind of laugh at them and interact with them, you got to wonder if that influences how he makes future films, right? I think a lot of people would argue with me, but in his case, I do think that he now makes films catering towards that kind of crowd, but still makes wild, you know, green screen heavy films, real political, sometimes tough to understand what he's saying. But he made this film called Fateful Findings. It is the most screened film in Philomoka. I think we showed it 8 or 9 times. Fateful Findings is a masterpiece, and it is completely pure. It is his vision. It is a wild Vision, highly recommended. One thing nobody's ever asked me about is my curation style, and I think that's good, because I think it's good that it remains a mystery. But I think that if you actually sit down and just look at our calendar, you will see that certain bases are always hit. I mean, the reason I agreed to this was just to be in the company of the other people you have interviewed. It's amazing.
It's amazing. I don't even understand what I've done to be at this point. I still, you know, like, I don't know. I was talking to a friend today about like imposter syndrome. And to me, imposter syndrome gets a lot worse when you're dealing with very famous people.
The people you talk to, though, are my favorite kinds of famous people. You know, they're the ones that most of their career, you know, they still lived kind of on the edge. Well, I mean, I think it's important because, like, take someone like Ann Magnuson. How many people under 30 are familiar with that name? You know, like, she has to be archived. Somebody who learns the name can then stumble upon your podcast.
Thank you so much for checking out this episode. We are on to some interesting things. We've got another about 14 episodes until we are finished with season 2. We're going to take a little break after that, maybe a month. We're trying to change things up a little bit. We're looking to move into more documentary kind of focus, maybe actually start doing more video stuff. But we got some great things coming up. We record a lot. I'm a teacher, so we record a lot in the off season. So we still have another 25, 30 episodes to put out that's been recorded, and we're recording some new ones. But then I'm taking a little break to focus more on photography. But you know, this has really been one of the best things in my life I've gotten to do. Please check out our website, vintagejamesarchive.com. If you don't follow the Instagram, please do so. Vintage Jams Archive, we've grown to about close to 53,000 followers. It's kind of shocking, but it's fun, you know. I can't even tell you how many times I have a panic where I'm like, okay, there's nothing left to post, and then I pull something out of my ass and I keep going. If you want to be a patron, we could really use money. We're looking to actually become a nonprofit at some point. Our goal really is to share people's legacy, build an archive, share people's stories. We really try very hard to be multicultural, to be inclusive of age, all different ages, all different different gender identifications, different races, really trying to highlight people's stories that aren't always highlighted. And so I'm feeling like in terms of money and such, I think it's natural progression that we're going to get more into nonprofit so we can get grants and, you know, do some things. We do give out some smaller grants to artists, maybe 3 or 4 a year, and I'm looking to do more of that. I really feel like it's very hard to get things made, whether it's a book or movie or, you know, an album, and we're just trying to really keep it independent by helping other people, you know, make their stuff in a way that they can benefit more than other companies. So anyway, check it out and enjoy, and please share about this. We don't have the kind of money to advertise yet. So anything you can do to share about the podcast is really welcome. Again, it's called the Vintage Annals Archive Visionary and Outsiders Podcast. Thank you.
Thought in different ways.